Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Dan Shearer. I'm local here in Adelaide, and I have a bit of a fascination with the topic of simulation at the moment, simulated whole systems. Hopefully we'll be able to explore that a little today. Thank you for coming along. I've just got some funky glasses to wear. Don't get excited or upset if you see me wearing these. I need it to see the screen, so it just helps. Plus it gives me just that allure, you know? Well, the topic is as advertised in the program, Linux and simulation, but the more I thought about it, the more I thought that really the subtitle was a much more appropriate topic. It's really where the simulation stuff takes us. Getting hardware and shoving it over SMTP is a good test of whether we've got some nice simulation technologies working or not. That's my test. As far as I know, it's even unique. Whether it's useful, you can judge. But I think it's very funny. It's a really true test for reliable simulation. Any questions, ask them as they come along, because sometimes the concepts get a little tangled in this topic. And so if you have any worries or concerns, or better ideas, please stick your hand up and tip them in straight away. And with that, we'll move along. Naturally, this is about Linux. To an extent, it's about the other three operating systems as well. But Linux lends itself peculiarly to simulation. My intention today is to go through why we have simulation at all, what's it useful for, how Linux fits into that picture, and a few simple little demonstrations. Has anyone here tried the live CD at all? Right, hands down if you couldn't get to do anything. If you take it in conjunction with the errata sheet, you can make it do some things. It's a bit of a dip your toe in the water example of what you can do with simulated systems. You user mode Linux happening and a few other things. That's good. And finally, I will go through a little bit of a worked example. In discussions with Philip Hazel here the last few days, Philip's the author of the XTIM mail package, which is exactly like the other MTAs, only better, or some version of that. It's actually solving a different problem to the other MTAs. But anyway. Philip was telling me that he's got this test rig that he runs every version of his XM mail package through before release. And the trouble with this test rig is Philip needs to run it all himself because it's all tuned and tweaked as some kind of a tottering stack of hacks. And that's great because we get better software if we test it regularly before release. But it's also not great because nobody else has got access to the Philip Hazel special testing service. So we don't actually know what it is that XTIM has to conform to before it's regarded as releasable. Wouldn't it be good if we could get that suite or some version thereof and make it available? The trouble is, to be a good test suite, really, you have to have a whole system environment. A .slash configure, which somehow creates an entire world, is a bit improbable. We need a way of picking up the whole computer or whole computer lab, the whole WAN that he's got, bundling it up in such a form that you can shove it over an SMTP connection. That's what I mean by tunneling hardware over SMTP. So hopefully we'll work through that example. And if the concepts seem to work, who knows, we might even get around to implement that. And most of this involves a slightly different approach to traditional topics. At the moment, it's somewhat of a niche technology. There are people who are quite fans of simulators. You've probably heard of the game of stacking emulators, where you get an emulator inside an emulator, and you get the Atari game simulator, and then inside that you run the Microsoft Windows simulator and all this sort of thing. there's party tricks you can play that are really quite good. But no doubt about it, it doesn't take a major part in mainstream computing considerations at this point in time. I suggest it's, of these three things here, it's probably generally been two of them. Slow, expensive, or difficult. So mainframe is around, if you look for people who look like they're probably from the mainframe era, I'll probably be able to tell you that simulation stuff, yes, we've been doing that since DOT. Which is perhaps slow, certainly expensive, and may or may not be difficult, but who knows, because nobody gets to try that out. Other kinds of technology generally have been one of these three things. You're probably familiar with some of full synthetic simulators like Box, the very good little x86 thing. That is definitely slow, which in a lot of environments is just not good enough. VMware, which has a different model again, it's not a full synthetic simulator, and we'll look at that, has cut some corners, and they've popularized the general idea. Sadly, the nearly 100% case for VMware is Windows on Windows. That's what people want to do. They want to have version X of Windows and then run version X plus one or X minus one in a window on the desktop, and that's where they make their money. VMware love Linux, they're full of Linux hackers, they've done some good things, and just the kernel boys, some really bad things. They have definitely raised the general awareness of the sorts of things you can do. So they've got GSX Server, and they're pushing products around that. That's not a model that I particularly think is terribly sustainable, but it certainly raised the profile. These days, we've got quite complex networks, and the idea of having continuity either in a financial or a technical sense from one project to the next, or having a machine that's doing its job right now, continuing to do its job despite changes in software hardware, that's become quite important. These days, testing is a big thing. In the free software field, lots and lots of people are saying, look, we're not doing enough testing, or the testing we do is not methodical enough. It's not iterative enough. The emergent properties, that is to say, the property of who has a blue clue, what it's going to do next, is basically increasing. The internet is getting more and more complicated, and you've got less and less of an idea of what might be on any given LAN. So you write a piece of software, someone takes it behind their firewall, they crank it up, it starts doing stuff, they have a problem. You've got less and less of an idea of how to predict how that problem may have arisen, because there's more and more complicated things happening. And finally, simulation these days is a lot better at supporting underlying current hardware. The one thing missing is a decent Power 4 or Power even G3 simulator around the place. Apart from that, all of the other major machine types can be simulated, many with open source technologies. That's where I'm aiming for. P.S. See my LAN as attached. That's why I want to get hardware tunneled over SMTP. And hopefully, even before the end of the talk, we'll get there. Very quickly then, before you get into the fancy bits, hopefully you can all see this. Great. Anyone got one of these on them? That's okay. I'll just draw some lines in the air. The general idea is that over time, software obsolescence goes a little bit like this. And somewhere here, someone pulls a plug and says, no, we've got to get that horrible, crusty old thing out of here. There's another curve for hardware, and often it goes a bit like this. Often the hardware runs out before the software does, particularly in applications like machine control, where you've got this PDP-11 crumbling to dust, but it's doing a great job. So they put in a Windows box running a PDP simulator, or a Linux box. I've got a PDP simulator that works really, really well, and things just keep running. So what the idea of simulation, there's a network obsolescence curve as well, but we won't worry about that too much. The idea of using simulation as a tool to stretch this out until the point that you wish to pull the plug is particularly powerful. And so software that was written perhaps 4 years ago, Linux, Windows, whatever, is relatively reliable. That's 2000, thank you, 2000 era. It's quite reasonable that software would still be doing a perfectly good job 4 years from now. It may well be that you can't afford to have the same hardware supporting that software for a whole lot of reasons. You don't have enough room in your computer center anymore for something that's a quarter as efficient as modern hardware. Or the hardware is IDE drives and at 8 years old, it's just getting a bit long in the tooth. It's possible using simulation technologies, such as VMware as an example, to get sector by sector dumps of the target system's disk and then boot that on a host system and perhaps boot three or four or five of these things. And indeed, there are companies around doing just that for things like print servers. Novell 3.11 print servers, they work just fine. The configuration can be heavily tweaked and whatnot, but they just, okay, fine, consolidate it all. Someone made a decision that it's easier than going through and doing a complete replacement, changing the configuration of things, or maybe the network would have gone out of certification if they did that. Has anyone ever worked in a pharmaceuticals lab or somewhere like that? Everything gets certified, and if you change the software parameters, then it's suddenly not certified anymore, and it's very painful and expensive. So these kind of things have a real application, and if they pass my, you can email the hardware test, you can do a lot of very useful things stretching out that obsolescence curve. That has obvious total cost of ownership type things. Under Linux, we've got absolutely everything. We've got a pluggable 86 emulator called QEMU. It's an emulation engine that will take 8086 instructions and operate on them just as if it was an 86 CPU. And it's pluggable. Absolutely beautiful. So people are busy bolting that on, for example, as a thing that comes along with Wine. Two things all in one, completely portable on your non-Intel architecture. There's Box, and it's been around a long time, and it's really getting some good capabilities. Peter Tatham, the trumpet windsock man from years ago down in Tasmania, he put Opteron chipset support in there. Instruction set support in there. It's a really flexible little simulator. Hercules is one of my favorites. Who's heard of Hercules? Anybody? Not many. All right. Hercules.cx, if I remember rightly, just Google it, is an extremely accurate implementation of the S390, in fact, S370, S390, and Z series IBM mainframe instruction sets and architecture. The buses and the device channels and the whole works. You can boot Linux for 390 on there. It works very, very well. In fact, it works well enough that I have had this thing on the internet running a real-world database-backed online application, and it worked. I don't believe I was the first to do it either. In fact, I think MOSFET did that first. But the idea of this being a little encapsulation of the real world is pretty close. It's slow. Why do you have a mainframe? Well, one of the reasons you have the mainframe is that the I/O throughput is absolutely amazing. If you have a look at the logo for the Linux on the 390 project, never trust a computer you can lift. There's some kinds of thinking involved with these machines that just is not reflected in a simulator you can run on your PC. However, there are some things, a lot of things in fact, that it's very good for. Z series, 64-bit. So you want to do some testing as to whether your code is 64-bit clean. You can't compile under Hercules. Linux under Hercules. Won't cost you anything. It'll run quite fast enough for you to SSH, or better still, Telnet into it, and start doing some things like gcc and type /configure. Here's your 64-bit testing platform. Who needs all this fancy hardware? Then there's closed source simulators. VMware, widely known, it's x86 specific, and it does all kinds of shufties behind the kernel's back, but it works. It definitely works for a lot of people. Kernel developers won't look at you if you come and say you have a kernel problem and VMware is anywhere near, because for their business model reasons, they've got closed source bits and pieces. But VMware certainly has opened a lot of people's eyes. What it does is use the virtualization features of the underlying Intel chip, and it flicks in and out of those of protector modes to do that. No, it doesn't. It flicks in and out of protected code pages. Peter, quick, what does it do? Then there's Simix, which is at the opposite end of the spectrum. Simix is a user space simulator, just like Box, but it's completely commercial, and it is really, really accurate. And you can get a 30-day free trial from Simix.net, but there's no way they're ever going to open source this thing. It's very, very accurate, including time clock accurate if you switch that on. Normally, if you run a simulator, the general idea is it's going to be slow, so you run it as fast as possible to get stuff done while you can, and then if something on the host machine goes slow, well, you slow down again. So to the application running in the simulator, time is going fast, slow, because the CPU megahertz is going up, down, memory access is getting faster and slower, interrupts happen wherever they jolly well please and all that. And you know what? Most of the time, it just doesn't matter. You're running simple user space processes. User mode Linux, for example. You run Mozilla under that on Fedora on your live CD. Not a problem. Who cares whether the time's going up and down? If you're doing time clock testing, tick, 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 looking for looking for race conditions or what have you, or testing that they've been fixed, what you need is a clock simulator. Simix gives you that. It's good enough that you can get a VHDL description of a new memory architecture that you've just built and plug it in the back end. That's not bad. It's also completely out of most people's needs. If you want to just email your hardware down the SMTP connection, get at the other end, pull out your LAN, boot it up and see what's going on, you don't need that kind of accuracy. Then there's network simulators, which again, for most system administrators and most developers, simply don't matter. But they are quite useful things. You can start to ask questions about what happens to congestion when I push packets up at this level, I make them on average this long, there's this much percentage of V6 on the wire. There's two very good ones, Simurid, which is nearly all in Spanish. They do say on the documentation, this English documentation was automatically generated, so please take note. It is a very, very good one. And NS2. I don't really want to cover network simulators today. They do exist, because there are these three things that tend to change and decay over time: hardware, software, networks. Be aware, maybe worth looking into it, if you run an ISP, something like that, the network simulators can be very, very helpful. If you've got Simix, it's all built in. Linux can simulate itself, and one of those technologies is user mode Linux. I believe it, for many respects, it's the most useful. There's a thing called vServ, very handy. vServ partitions up your machine so that you can have separate root logins and you can run separate little worlds, but it's basically like, should we say, chroot on steroids. That's probably the best I could describe it. So that means some process goes absolutely wild in one vServ session, and then your whole machine starts to become sluggish. With user mode Linux, each session, as we'll see later on in the talk, is actually around about 4 user space processors, and so you can use things like NICE to bring the priority down. Have a look at what's going on with BSD. What do you call it? BSD. Thank you. The BSD process management stuff, and you just use a user space tool to pull out the results from the kernel as to what processes have been using up which resources lately. And you say, oh goodness me, this one's being a bit greedy, isn't it? I'll tune that one and run it down. So everything is just like as if you're running a big web server, and you're looking at all these web server processes, and you say, oh, that one's gone wild, I'll do something about it. User mode Linux, the design of it is most interesting, and we'll go into that when it comes time to do a bit of a demo. In short, I'm just going to say this much. User mode Linux is a port of Linux to its own system call interface. The example I often use is that when the user mode Linux kernel says calloc, like kalloc, which says kernel allocation, which is a kernel space operation, that gets mapped on the host system, what I often call the mothership, because we've got a namespace collision like crazy in simulation. I call it the mothership, not the host, because you've got hosts everywhere. Back on the mothership, that gets mapped to an ordinary user space malloc. So if there's no more memory available on the host system, that fails. There's no way that it's any kind of privileged operation. It has no priority over, for example, your SQL server that's running on that main system. In that way, it's its own separate port in its own separate tree in a Linux kernel source. So you've got the alpha port all the way through to, you know, your PowerPC and your who knows what else, and you've got a user mode Linux. It's arch equals UM, the user mode. So we'll just have a bit of a look here. At the very, very simple end, because this illustrates the concepts, this is the one on the live CD. It doesn't work for everybody. Who did actually get UC Linux coming off the live CD and the web? Did it work for you? Sort of. Did the web server bit not quite work, or? Oh, really? I know that there are some issues. Oh, we've got a few others. All right, sounds like there's some that it didn't work on. If it didn't work, chances are, in fact, almost certainly, it was to do with the environment that the thing's found at boot up. There's timeout issues there. I don't really know what they are. But if it didn't work for you at boot up time, you can certainly run it after the fact. I'm pretty sure I put this on the is that a halt? Just very quickly make function. Well, just while Tim makes this come out on the projector, as I was going to say, we're talking about the UC Linux port. That's the first thing. UC Linux is one great big glob of source code, one of which has a directory called Linux. And another one has a directory called user. And under user, it has things called HTTP, bash, and PS, or proc utils, or something or other. All these other familiar things we're used to seeing. That's all in one huge big tree. And all the things under user are hacked about so that every time it references a username, for example, or UID information and so on, it's if def, embed, and it's gone. Because UC Linux is for tiny devices that have no such possibility of multiple users and so forth. So it really is quite simple. And when you've configured it up, you get a ROM file. And you stuff this ROM file into an emulator that can read the ROM file, execute it as if it was a device, in this case, a Palm 3. in a Palm 3, or this implementation of the Palm, the Palm 3 spec, you can have a few devices. There's the graffiti scratch pad, and there's all sorts of other things. There's no Ethernet device, but there is a serial device. And because there's a serial device, you can do networking, because you all know about PGP. And if there's a problem with PGP here, the author's right here in the lecture theater, so it should be fine. No can do? Right, okay. Well, if it's crashed. Yep, no worries. Borrowed laptops are always exciting. So what we do is we start this program. Should it come up on the screen? Yes, it does. Look at that. And we ask it to run in serial mode. PPP connects to it over the connection in the usual sort of way. There's a little conversation that says start up PPP Yorin, and away we go. We've got LCP packets and hey presto, it's on the network. Can go ping. And so I started up a web server on that. It's a 500 line C code web server. This is not Apache, it's not even Boa. Those are far too big. Had no end of grief over that. It's a 500 line web server, and it works for most people. I have only had one report of failure, and that's in this room. Palm have got actually another one called POSE, which doesn't work with Linux yet. Now that we know that works, what does that mean? We have magic. Oh, thank you. Now we know that works. We'll just let that boot away. It's a synthetic simulation, meaning the CPU is completely emulated. It's not jumping out and doing virtual 86 stuff. Hardly likely, since it's a tiny Motorola. Is it accurate? It is actually. It's not bad at all. Hello. It's booting just nicely. It's fairly accurate. One of the reasons is, even though it's an open source project, it's only got a fairly simple target. I mean, how hard is a Palm pilot be, really? There's some bugs in it. There's only one architecture supported. A lot of simulators support more than one. It doesn't do clever things like multi-CPUs or anything like that, because, well, that would be amazing. You certainly could do it, but I've never heard of it in real life, and maybe it wouldn't be much point in it. I don't know, actually. Now I've mentioned it. You could do it. I've seen where you could do it in the source of Xcode Pilot. That's it. Challenge. Hackfest challenge. At 10 CPU Palm 3. The speed. Now you go cat proc CPU info, and the speed that it comes up with is about twice what you get on a real Palm 3. Because modern hardware is really good. And so this is not a clock simulation. Just go as fast as you can. In this case, it easily outraces the target hardware. So how many bits to email? We have a ROM file, and we have a configuration file for the simulator. In fact, we can figure that one out. So it's one thing to email, about a 2 meg file. I mean, a Word document that says, "Hello Fred, how are you?" That's 2 megs. So people do this all the time, which is good. This is a very simple case of tunneling the hardware over this MPP. Now we'll look at that. It's just coming out right now. The next one, we'll look at both of these together. So I'll discuss them first, then we'll look at them. Including fixing one of the most embarrassing bugs that I've created for a very long time. It's a practical simulation of Box. Now, it's actually, I call it homebrew, because it is a real mongrel. I mean, you say, what hardware does it implement? The answer is nothing that actually exists. I mean, we've got x86-64 instruction set on something that can't even do PCI bus master. So, what they've done is take well-understood bits of PC hardware, bang them together with interfaces that are also aligning what stood, and just hope that it all works. And the nice thing is, ordinary operating systems, commodity ones, do work. I've got NetBSD, we'll boot up NetBSD, and show you. Right, look at that. uclinux.example.com. That is running off the web server, running in the Palm 3 at the top left-hand corner. And it's not the fastest thing in the world, because I think it's 5 megabits or something like that. But it does, in fact, work. I've asked. There we go. Slow, 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 slow. Boom. That's that little 500-line C code web server running under a tiny little Motorola chip, predecessor to the Motorola ColdFire, simulated by Xcode Pilot, running under Linux. And it works. Amazing. In fact, if you want to see what's actually going on, that's all sort of still this. I've got a fake bag. Well, it's all fake. If you want to actually see what's going on, you grab your live CD, you go, click. Thanking INET enormously for following this thing. And that's the file that actually does the doing. And what we've got here, we'll just get rid of the serial connection. Pop down here. Delete the model serial. Make it so it doesn't really have any background. And talking to you. Not 100% sure what's going on here. What have we got? It's a nice laptop. Well, I'm assuming I'm completely unresponsive editor. We will probably move right away from this, because there's damage on the other. Instead, I'll pop into the box. Mainly, because I have a good way to take that. LCA. Sim. What is it called? This is the most embarrassing bug, without question, that I've created for a very long time. Late at night, thought I had a happy little error message, put a smiley in, and of course it didn't escape the bracket and the smiley, did I? Alright. Now, just bringing up Box here. First of all, it copies a 64 meg image to the RAM disk. Takes a little minute. And then it'll start up Box and boot from that image on the RAM disk. The reason it's copied to the RAM disk is that it has to write to it. Unlike user mode Linux, Box has a need to write to the image, shall we say, in real time. This, by the way, if you've never seen it before, is what NetBSD looks like as it boots. It's ready to go there. It's found some hardware. You can see it's detected that there's a chip underneath there, and it's got all kinds of things coming up. It's detected some ports. You can see if I flick back to the box, it's been probing all kinds of ports that don't exist under box, and boxes say, hey, I didn't know what to do with this one. But that's okay, because it didn't do anything, and the NetBSD operating system, this is completely unmodified, straight from the install CPU, straight from the dash current CBS tree, NetBSD, it knows PC hardware differs. And because PC hardware differs, it's expecting a whole range of different results, and it's all happy. Here it's going through its init scripts, and because this is to support the talk about signed binaries, then it's complaining that I haven't got any fingerprints for all these different binaries. That's all right. Go and talk to Brett Lim and find out about his signed binaries, if you want to know what that means. But basically, it's a successful boot. I think the main point to take away here is that it's an unmodified kernel, as opposed to use mode Linux, which is not booting in a sandbox like this at all. It's its own standalone thing. So I call it homebrew for the reasons stated above. Is it accurate representation of any hardware? No way. Is it useful? Yes, it is. Look, it's booting NetBSD. That's pretty close to a real PC as far as I'm concerned. It's just that I can't buy or build one like that. And if I switch on Opteron instruction set support, it still boots, at least the right NetBSD will boot. The speed is around about 100 times slower than the target, if you notionally cobble together what a target means in this case. Bits to email. We have an image file, such as just copying the RAM disk. We have a config file for the box simulator. We have, would you believe, a BIOS. A special BIOS built just for box. Very nice indeed. And there's a VGA BIOS as well. And you probably either refer to the versions or attach them to your email, and away you go. That's getting up, this right here would be a 64 megabyte email attachment. And I think that's perfectly reasonable, just lots of Word files. User mode Linux, one of my favourite things at the moment. Is it synthetic simulation? No. Nobody sat down and said, when I see an instruction that says add, then I get this variable over here and this variable over here, and I go in C, I say variable A plus variable B, there's a result, I put that in that fake register. None of that happens. Alright, that's what's happening with box, as you can see, completely synthetic. User mode Linux is a different beast altogether. The idea is, being a port of Linux itself, it's generating a binary that runs on the host platform. Therefore, it's going to be native mode execution of the particular 86 flavor that it's compiled for. So if you've got a very fast host that's got some, say, Pentium 4 extensions, and everything in the whole machine is compiled with those extensions, your user mode Linux applications can benefit in the same way. I think that might be a little bit obscure. I have a program called User Bin Linux that allows me to do things like kill all Linux, and it actually does something, and renice Linux up and down. I can go px and see what it's doing. User Bin Linux was compiled. It was compiled like /bin/ls. In fact, they're very, very similar in many ways. We just compiled them into a source of code using whatever toolchain was on the host system. In this case, the source code was a copy of the Linux kernel tree with the architecture set to BUN, not IPFS6, not ARM, not MIPS, but UM for user mode Linux. And that generates just an application. And you can do all the application type things. I can say, for example, look, I can log on to NetBSD. Now, I think I'll log on as root. Oh, Tommy, problems. Anyway, the other nice thing about using such simulators, logged on. Oh, there's more. Wonderful. Is that, frankly, we don't care very much. Not at all. So, what is this? We just say, bye bye. Gone. Which is very nice. Now, while this. Okay. Actually, it's not all because of that, is it? Kill. And it'll take its time, but I think it's going to die. This is a 256 megabyte laptop, and I'm really amazed at the sorts of things that will run. So I can say things like that. Linux minus 112. Yes, Kim. No, you can't, unfortunately. There is some chipset architecture specific stuff under there, in particular how it handles jumping backwards and forwards from handling kernel scripts, trapping those kernel calls, basically, requires some jiggery pokery in knowing about how things are pushed onto the stack and popped off again. There is a partial port to PowerPC. I would love to see that finished. As soon as I understand it, I'd like to have a go. Hardware. I am going to have a go. But that's the only other hardware port that's been attempted. I was just about to say that Jeff Dyke, the main maintainer for this, found a huge big IA64 box on his doorstep the other day. One would presume that HP would like IA64 supported. What it does mean, I would say, is that someone wakes up quick enough, there can be a bit of a race between power and an IA64 because power is well in advance. But Jeff codes quickly. So being able to go Linux minus help gives us the idea that there's a whole lot of other things we can do, and there's more things built in. User mode Linux has some networking stuff built in, for example. And it's got a little console thingy, all for its very own self, that if it's running, you can connect to it using a little tool called mConsole, connects to a Firefox, and you can say halt or suspend or reboot, that kind of thing, which is a fake way right into the deep into the depths of user mode Linux that doesn't exist in the real world. But very, very handy having this virtualization method. The architectures it supports, well, it's its own architecture, but then again also it's reflecting in a much more limited sense the architecture underneath, be it fast, be it small, whatever, not whether it's multi-CPU or not. That's an exception. If you've got a four-way SMP box, and you run user mode Linux on it by default, it's just got a one processor inside it. You can do some tricks and compile it so that we have as many processors as you know, a reasonable number of processors up to four inside user mode Linux, and that is independent of the number of processors on the host machine. Very cute. If you would like to test your new software application on a dual CPU machine to see if it gets spin locked right or what have you, then you start up user mode Linux with two CPUs, and away you go. You're running on a single CPU laptop, not a problem, you've still got two CPUs. As far as I know, It's as close as any application needs to come, and that includes file system drivers. Can anyone correct me on that? Because I'm not a file system driver developer yet. No? Good. I'm pretty sure it's correct. At least as far as I've looked at it. Now, we get up to about three quarters of the target system, the host system speed, or the system we are simulating. So if you've got a 2 gig Pentium and you're running a user mode Linux session underneath, you can probably get around about 0.75 of a performance when you say run Mozilla inside that, as you do if you're running it outside that. That's pretty good. And in fact, we're improving it all the time. There's some things in the pipeline. If it all comes out, we'll be getting better than 85% of the host system speed. That is really impressive. And that's why some people have spotted this, and there are actually service providers around who are just beginning to offer online access, take your credit card here, and dial in SSH into your very own user mode Linux root prompt. We've got one here in Adelaide, it's just happening. That's the whole thing, the Linux thing. So, this is a very efficient, compared to synthetic simulation, this is incredibly efficient. It's not as efficient as the IBM mainframers will tell you, oh, but I just start up another VM, so that's true, that's buried deep in that hardware. We'd have no hardware support for using mode Linux whatever, and it's really good. I've run up to 100 sessions on one computer. That's 100 computers, each with their own IP address, all ping flooding the same virtual Ethernet, and all of them transportable by SMTP. Two pieces to email, really. You really need to know the config for the kernel, the user mode Linux kernel, and maybe some command line parameters. You put that in the text of the message that was in town. And, of course, the image for this user mode Linux, because you have to have a virtual file system somewhere. Which brings me to the demo. If I go to my LCA Live CD, to LCA Sim, what do I call it? Fedora. Got some files there. I'm going to say what you will see scrolling past the screen when I flick Virtual Console back is the boot sequence of what you would expect to come up on an ordinary Intel computer. That actually is completely gone now because this machine has started up an X console, an X session on another virtual console. Good old CWM. I just thought it was lightweight. But you do not fit really good. Good. These are for the virtual consoles that you would get at a physical machine. So Alt F1, Alt F2, and so on. You're sitting down there, you've got full control because you've got physical access. That's what you take from like your man and screwdriver. Yes, which is no security protection. And then in another virtual console, I'm starting up another X session that is being a client that is having an X conversation with that user mode Linux Fedora instance. So let's just go back and have a look at that very carefully. What I see, here we are, look familiar? Scrolling up the screen, there is a process on my computer called Linux, a user mode process. It booted and the boot sequence stuff went scrolling past the screen. Might that look familiar? Except for this bit at the top, which said, here's my command line. And that's what I could have typed actually at the bash prompt. Mem equals 64 meg. ETH 0 equals TUNTAP. That's referring to imaginary Ethernet devices, TAP 0, TAP 1, and so on. That's how we can bring up ETH 0 inside the virtual machine. And then away it goes. That's using mode Linux. So then I, that means quick question time is about to start, I believe. No, we're just about to see the demo here. So we'll go then to F6. Here we are, and we should have some consoles. Look at that, we've got some root consoles. So we've got root and Live City. Remember, this is a 256 megabyte laptop, not running a very fast Pentium processor. So you can do a lot with a little, and it's booted off a CD. If config, look at ETH0. That's that, and the outside world, I can see a TAP0 device. On the inside world, it's ETH0. And so I can ping, there's a virtual bridge there actually, I can ping that, ping all VR, and it goes ping, over the virtual Ethernet. This would be really good for testing the exit, surely. And then just because it's there, I can just say that we do have one of these. And so you can log on and run your end stuff, but that doesn't help us test exit, so we don't worry about that too much. If we just go back to the master system, we'll start up a new shell. It's getting low on RAM here. We'll just have a quick look at LCA, Sim, Fedora. You can see that there's a file, an image there, 500 meg file. It's actually a sparse file which weighs in at 300 megs, so it's not so bad. That's the bit you email. Inside that is a file system. You can, I can mount that file system on a loopback. You can go mount minus O loop, and then maybe your MS-DOS floppy or whatever. Exactly the same way, I go mount minus O loop this file called Fedora, and it mounts an X3 file system with all the goodness in it that just booted up the screen. That's the bit you can email. And this is, I would suggest, a good way forward. We'll skip Hercules. It's much the same, only very, very different, because it's a mainframe. Portable XIM testing, if we want reproducible results, then we do the user mode Linux thing. That's my suggestion. It might be that you've got this tottering pile of nasty little shell scripty hacks, because after all, testing is a very specific thing. It doesn't matter, as long as everyone's got exactly the same tottering heap of very nasty little hacks, we'll have a consistent testing environment. So using a single UML instance, that's a live CD, or indeed. Thank you. We could do it like the live CD, or we can get really clever and do a WAN. What I'd like to do then is jump back as there are questions to any point in this presentation, because I expect that there are questions. That's my suggestion for a kind of a thought experiment solution for testing a fairly complex program like Exit. Questions? Yes, at the back. Right. Absolutely. A great application. In fact, there's a gentleman in New Zealand who's got all the specs online. You can build your own little network testing lab using user mode Linux, and you've got fake networks and borders and routers and you name it. Any other questions? No, it's not, but it's Canterbury University, so I reckon if you Google for user mode Linux Canterbury, maybe New Zealand, so you don't get the home of the Exim author, it'll all come good. No, that's Cambridge, sorry. Any other questions? Peter? Have I tried Zed? Oh, the XDM. Yeah, I have. Now, that is a different model again. And in some ways, it's the right model to use, I would say. It involves hacking the kernel of whatever you're going to run, which is okay for Linux. I have tried it. It's better performance than user mode Linux, but I find there's useful as an encapsulation technology. That's my own opinion so far. I find a lot less emailable. So it passes my test, but not with flying colours, because I've found it quite difficult to use. Now, it's very good if you want to have a cluster of servers that are all making good shared use of those resources. I don't think it's so good if you want to do something like reproducible software testing. There you go. It's a short version. Anything further? Oh, there we go, Tim.